Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you are listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. And we are your hosts, Brooke Wright and Ronnie Lipschitz. Over the last couple of years, we've had a number of shows on solar technology, policy, and politics. Today, our guest is Benjamin Eichert, director of Let's Green California, an initiative launched by the Romero Institute in Santa Cruz to create a California Green New Deal and get the core legislation passed into law by September 30th, 2022. Let's Green California has also created Electrify California based on a simple idea: make the switch from fossil fuel-based technologies to electric alternatives powered by clean energy, and ensure that low-income communities and working families both lead and benefit from this transition. We are going to focus on how citizen-based campaigns go from plan to policy. Ben Eichert, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Ben. So let's start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. My name's Benjamin Eichert, and I work with the Romero Institute. The Romero Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization based in Santa Cruz. And we do most of our work through sort of separate programs. We really have two primary programs. One, which we've been working on, is really sort of our flagship program. Been doing some work since 2004 with Native American tribes and leaders in North and South Dakota, primarily. That project's called the Lakota People's Law Project. We work across a range of social justice issues, everything from child and family welfare to treaty rights, environmental preservation. We were pretty heavily involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline fight, Keystone XL, Line 3, a number of others. More recently, in 2016, we launched a California climate-focused project. It was originally called Green Power. Today, it's called Let's Green California. Mm-hmm. And I lead that program, and we're really focused on building solutions to the climate crisis from the community level up.
Okay, tell us more about that.
Sure. You know, I would say that oftentimes the approach to addressing climate is a sort of top-down approach, right? So you might pass a law that says, for example, 100% of California's energy needs to come from renewable sources. And so that's the law. It sets this goal. And then it's really up to the state executive branch agencies to figure out how that's going to get accomplished, what sorts of regulations need to be put in place. And there's sort of a hope that as we move toward that goal, the benefits of that process are going to trickle down to mm-hmm. people at the community level. At Let's Green California, we want to take that approach and flip it on its head. So instead of setting a goal at the top and hoping that everything trickles down, we want to really focus on what are the steps that need to be taken to getting us there. How do we put in place the jobs, for example? You know, let's focus on really identifying what those jobs are, how that work is going to get done. We want to look at frontline communities, those communities that are traditionally either left behind in climate policies or overlooked. And we want to focus on those communities. How do we make sure that those communities are leading the way? You know, many years ago when I first started getting involved in climate policy, I was talking to a friend of mine who's the mayor of a small town in Ohio. And he said, look, if you want people to care about climate, then you got to make sure that solar jobs are good jobs. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. If we believe that if we take a bottom-up approach that really focuses on people first, then we can hopefully change the consciousness of Californians and become excited about addressing the climate crisis in the state.
Right, right. What? So you described the pipeline project, which is not in California, but then the Romero Institute is based in California. Can you help me understand, are those the two arms or how that happened?
Sure. Well, yeah, the Romero Institute is based in California, has been based up here in the Monterey Bay Area in Santa Cruz for quite some time, since the early 2000s, if I remember correctly. In 2004, our organization's leaders were doing some work. They have a bit of a history of doing some work around Native American rights and Native American justice. And our organization's president, Danny Sheehan, who's an attorney connected with a Lakota grandmother and leader, a woman named Madonna Thunderhawk. And it really started around, you know, she was communicating to the team about what was really an epidemic of Native American children being removed from their homes by the South Dakota State Department of Social Services and placed into white foster care homes or state-run foster care facilities in direct contravention of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which says in order to preserve the culture of Native American nations, Native American children who need to be removed from the home should be placed in other Native American settings. Well, the state of South Dakota was completely ignoring that law. It's one of the worst violators. And Danny and Madonna started working together, and, you know, it grew from there. And today it's actually, you know, today it's a program that has national and even international reach and works on some pretty big projects and accomplishes some pretty amazing things. I did some work with the project most recently in 2020, when we worked with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and created a phone bank of 30 Standing Rock tribal members who were calling other Native American voters and voters who care about the environment across the country and educating them about the issues at stake in the election.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Well, I hope we have some time to get into that again towards the end of this.
Sure.
We definitely want to get into the Green New Deal as a starting point, though. So most of our listeners have heard about the Green New Deal, but there are numerous efforts to get a California Green New Deal through the state legislature now. Could you describe some of those efforts and, you know, in addition to the ones being led by the Romero Institute?
Sure. Well, I'm not familiar with all of the various efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, what I can tell you is this. California has historically been a leader in climate policy, really, and continues to be a leader to this day. But I would say that there are quite a number of other states that have really caught up, and maybe our pace has slowed a little bit. Hmm. You know, I think of maybe there were the most recent really significant environmental or climate change policies that we've implemented here in the state. Number one, Senate Bill 100, which set a goal of getting to 100% clean energy in our grid, I think by 2045. Mm-hmm. Governor Jerry Brown issued an executive order near the end of his final term mandating that the state get to carbon neutrality by 2045. And then Governor Newsom recently issued an executive order saying that we should get to 100% zero emission vehicle sales by 2035. But in terms of policy, in terms of laws, there haven't really been any groundbreaking climate laws passed in California for quite some time. Even the Speaker of the Assembly, Anthony Rendon, recently stated when he was in Scotland for COP, he said he felt that California has fallen behind. Hmm. Nevertheless, there are a number of efforts out there. You know, they range everywhere from bills that would codify Governor Newsom's executive order or bills that would codify Governor Brown's executive order, or bills in a, you know, across a whole range of approaches. But I think that one of the things that they do have in common, or at least most of them have in common, is what I was talking about a little bit earlier, sort of a top-down, regulatory-driven approach to addressing the crisis. And what we're doing this year is we have introduced a bill. The Romero Institute and Let's Green California are co-sponsors of the bill, along with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. We've introduced a bill. It's called Senate Bill 1230, and it's being authored by State Senator Monique Lamone, who represents parts of Ventura County and I believe almost all of Santa Barbara County on the southern part of the Central Coast. And that bill would aim to do a couple of things. I'll talk more about that in just a minute, but I think it's a little bit more of an example of the type of approach that overall we want to take, which is more of this bottom-up approach, really focusing on cost and consumers first, jobs and workers first, equity and frontline communities first.
Nice. Could you tell a little bit more about SB 1230 specifically?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll go back. I think you mentioned Electrify California. So
right.
What we started working on about a year and a half ago is trying to put together a comprehensive or a holistic public policy approach to addressing the climate crisis. Number one, to start with, and I think many people agree with this, we're not doing as much as we need to do, either here in California or in the United States or globally. We are way behind. In California specifically, there have been a couple of reports recently that have noted that California is not on track to meet its 2030 emissions reduction goals until probably 2060. Yep. Transportation is a big reason why. So we started working on a policy, would be called a policy framework, a group of policies that cohere together to reach a goal. And we said, what would it take? What would a policy approach actually look like to get California to meet its existing emissions reduction goals by 2030? Mm-hmm. And because we believe that really something serious needs to be done by 2030, right? We have a window of time to act, and we really need to get serious. And California, as a historic leader, really needs to lead the way and create a template and a model that other states and other nations can follow. Mm-hmm. So we started working on developing a set of policies, and we really zeroed in on transportation, also the built environment. And I think you mentioned at the beginning, it's based on a pretty simple principle. If we take all of the technology in our lives that currently runs and is powered by fossil fuels, gas, oil, methane gas, gasoline, whatever it is, and we switch from that technology over to new electric power technology, and as you know, we have pretty clean energy in California. Our grid is one of the cleaner grids in the country. We no longer use coal. There's still some natural gas left, but if we switch from fossil fuel power tech over to electric tech, and that electric tech is powered by a clean grid, then we can eliminate really massive amounts of our greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's the concept of electrification, and it's really a pretty hot topic in the world of climate policy. A lot of people talk about electrifying everything. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's so straightforward to electrify everything, but we really should be electrifying our transportation and our built environment, meaning our homes. And not only are there really big climate benefits from doing that, there are also really big public health benefits. In fact, there's a recent study that came out just last week, I believe, from the American Lung Association that says nationally, if we rapidly transitioned to electric vehicles, the country could save something like $1.2 trillion, or there would be about $1.2 trillion in public health benefits over the next 30-some years. Mm. So we put together this policy framework that looks at electrifying California on a really rapid timeline, really focusing on getting as close as we can to 100% of what's referred to as 100% replacement by 2030. So by 2030, if you are driving a gasoline-powered car and it breaks down, you need a new car, then you would have to go get a zero-emission car. Or in your home, if your cooktop that's powered by methane gas breaks down, you need a new cooktop, then you would have to go get an electric or an induction cooktop, something like that. Doesn't mean that any of the technology that's still operable by that time, it's not like anyone's going to come take that away or you'd be forced to give it up. Mm-hmm. It's what's referred to as replacement. When it's time to replace the tech that you have, then you've got to replace it with clean tech. And so that's what this policy framework focuses on, Electrify California, is getting the state there as quickly as possible. Senate Bill 1230 carves out of that framework a small portion of policies, really a pair of policies that focus on speeding up the transition to electric vehicles among passenger vehicles, right? Just cars that you and I use for our everyday purposes, right? We're not focused on big semi-trucks or long haulers. Really focused on how can we get Californians into zero-emission vehicles as quickly as possible.
Great. Ben, let me take a pause. We need to go to a short break, and then let's come back, and I actually want to ask you about that, about this focus on the passenger cars. Thank you. So you are listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz. That is 90.7 FM, also KSQD.org on the internet. And this is Sustainability Now. And I am your host, Brooke Wright, with Ronnie Lipschitz in the studio. And our guest today is Ben Eichert from Let's Green California, an initiative of the Romero Institute. Thank you again, Ben, for being part of this show.
My pleasure.
Great. So we were just talking about SB 1230, which is the Electrify California legislation Romero Institute is working on, and putting passenger vehicles as the focus. And I just wanted to ask about that. What, why not focus on electrification as a whole? What is it about passenger vehicles?
Well, number one, it's hard to do everything at once, right? Unfortunately, I would say the way that passing legislation works in Sacramento is it happens a piece at a time or a chunk at a time. And we would ultimately like to get to a place where the legislature is focused on larger and more comprehensive bills that can address huge and entire sectors of emissions at a time. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
Okay.
So we decided to focus on a small piece because we think it's one of the areas where we can see, you know, the biggest bang for the buck, the biggest return, and that's in passenger vehicles. California is poised for a huge breakthrough in electric vehicles. Right now, we're already leading the country. I think last year, about 12% of vehicle sales were zero-emission vehicles. We had been stuck at about 8% for 3 years before that. But if you look at California in an international context, we're pretty far behind the leaders. In Norway, about 65% of new cars sold in 2021 were electric vehicles. In the Netherlands, 30% of new cars sold last year were zero-emission vehicles. In China, 15% of cars, I think, last year sold were zero-emission vehicles. So California is further behind. And I think that we're poised for a breakthrough. I think that those numbers that we've seen in California over the last 3 or 4 years really could jump for a number of reasons.
Tell me. Number one,
yeah, people are more familiar with electric cars, and there's just it's less of a sort of mysterious technology, right? People get it that, hey, these cars are just as good, if not better, than a gasoline-powered
right.
car. I personally think they're quite a bit better.
Also, there's the range issue. Some of those countries you described might not, you know, in the Netherlands, that's so much smaller than California, right? So they probably weren't as affected by the range issue.
And that's true.
Now cars have so much range. I mean, electric cars.
Yeah, range on electric cars has certainly been growing. Mm-hmm. We've been doing better as a state in installing charging infrastructure too, although I think we still have a long way to go. And SB 1230 addresses part of that. I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
But I think that California is poised for a breakthrough. I mean, California really was the birthplace of the electric car in many regards. And I think we should be further ahead than we are. One of the other reasons that I think we're poised for a breakthrough is there are all sorts of new models of electric vehicles entering the market. Really, for many years, kind of Tesla was your main choice, and then General Motors brought in the Bolt and Nissan brought in the Leaf. But there were just a handful of models available. I think, if I remember correctly, there's going to be something like 30, 40, even maybe 50 different models of electric vehicles available in California this year and next. And so consumers have many more choices that might appeal or speak to their priorities.
Right.
So we think California is ready for a breakthrough, but there are two big barriers that we see to people adopting electric vehicles. There's a Deloitte study that came out recently that you know sort of reaffirmed this. Number one, cost is a barrier. Electric cars are more expensive than their sort of gasoline-powered equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
There's also range anxiety and a perceived lack of access to charging. Those two things really go hand in hand, right? The range of your vehicle is less of an issue if there's a charger on every street corner.
And if they fast charge, right?
And if they can fast charge, yeah. I should maybe say if there's a fast charger on every corner.
Yeah.
So those are two of the biggest barriers. And so SB 1230 aims to address those barriers, right? And again, this is sort of this idea of a bottom-up. We say, okay, so if cost is a barrier, how do we address cost? We've got to ensure that there are incentives, state incentives that will help close the cost gap that are easy to understand, easy to apply for, and easy to use. There are already state incentives, and I'll talk more about them in just a minute, but I don't think that they're easy to understand or easy to use.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we need to do is if access to charging is a barrier to adoption of electric vehicles, then we need to really ramp up the speed with which we're building new electric chargers and fast chargers especially. What's been happening is that the building of chargers lags behind the demand for electric vehicles. Really, it should be the other way around. we should be building as many chargers today as we think we're going to need tomorrow, right? Or this year, we should be building enough charging infrastructure to meet next year's need. And so that's what SB 1230 aims to do, is to address those two things,
right?
To remove the barriers for consumers, for people to get into electric vehicles, and to focus on really identifying and funding the jobs that need to happen,
right,
to build that infrastructure.
Let's talk about the rebates for a second, because I actually did lease an electric car back when it was relatively unusual for people to have them. I feel like it was like 2015. I can't remember exactly. But it was really easy at that time. When I went to the car lot to lease the car, it was a lease, so maybe that's different, but it was all built into the price and it was very simple. And I'm just trying to understand, did that become harder over time to be able to access all of those rebates? Because I know that that's part of this legislation, is to make that rebate access really streamlined and simple at the point of sale, potentially. Can you share how that, maybe the rebate programs have shifted over time?
Yeah, so I'm actually not sure what they were like when you leased your vehicle. What I can do is I can tell you what they're like now.
Perfect.
We did quite a bit of work. This is how SB 1230 came about, by the way. We have done some work over the last couple of years doing education and outreach primarily to low-income communities to let them know about the different incentives that are available to help them get into an electric vehicle. But it's confusing. There are really five or more different incentives in the state of California, and each one works in a different way and has to be applied for through a different application and can be used at a different time. I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a clean fuel reward. That's $750. That's kind of tied to a new electric vehicle. You take it at the point of purchase at the dealer. Then there's the clean vehicle rebate program. That's a rebate that you have to apply for as the purchaser, or if you lease a vehicle, you have to apply for that rebate after you've bought or leased the vehicle. Sometimes it can take months to receive the rebate. And so that's something that doesn't work very well if you're a low-income consumer, because you don't necessarily have the money to pay up front and then wait months for a rebate, right? There's the enhanced clean vehicle rebate, which provides additional amount for low-income consumers. There's the clean vehicle assistance program. That's a grant that you apply for before you purchase the vehicle. Then there's the Clean Cars for All program. That's assistance if you're trading in an old, higher polluting vehicle. So you can see it's kind of confusing. It's not uniform. Some you can use at the point of sale. Some you apply for after you buy. Some you apply for before you buy. What SB 1230 does is it would simplify this entire process. It would create one portal where people can go to learn about the money that's available, fill out one application, be approved within 24 hours, and see in one place all of the incentives that they're going to receive. Mm-hmm. And then they could go into a participating dealer and use that incentive money at the point of sale as part of their down payment to either purchase or lease a vehicle. So it would really simplify and streamline the process and make it easier to understand. There's a study that came out a few years back that really said, if you want people to really make use of the incentives, they really need to be easy to understand and they need to be point of sale. So we're trying to achieve those things with regard to the rebates and incentives.
Okay. Great. Let's see. So how about, you mentioned another thing. So there was the rebates and then also the access to chargers. So can you talk a little bit about how the legislation will create more, is it incentives to personal property owners that have parking lots to install more chargers, or how is it hoping to create a world where there's a lot more chargers?
Sure. Well, there are, it's very happy to report that there are a couple of different bills this year that touch on charging. Ours would focus on what's referred to as public charging. So that's charging that's available to the public generally, right? Wouldn't focus on someone's personal charger at their home. It's really charging that's available to the public. And what the bill would do is a couple of things. Number one, we should note that there's a ton of federal money coming to the state to support electric vehicle charging infrastructure. That money is coming as part of the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed and signed into law last year. So the state's going to have a ton of funding to build charging infrastructure. What the bill says is we need to speed up the rate at which we're building the charging, and we need to build enough charging in each year to meet what the anticipated demand for charging will be in the following year. Additionally, it says 50% of the state funds invested in building charging infrastructure need to be invested in building chargers in disadvantaged communities. Finally, it says that preference should be given to chargers that are at or near multi-unit housing. And then finally, it says that preference should be given to charging projects that minimize demand on the electrical grid, either by incorporating, or like by, for example, incorporating photovoltaic, solar, and battery storage. So that's basically on the charging side. What the bill does is it says you got to just really speed up the rate at which you're building charging. The state has to ensure that enough charging is built each year to meet next year's demand. Right. That way, it won't continue to be a barrier to people adopting.
Mm-hmm. But so what kind of sites would it be? If you had a multifamily housing project, then where would the chargers be? Is it in the parking lot there, or is it nearby? Like, where do you foresee that happening?
Yeah, it could be in the lot. So that what the bill says is at or near. So it could be in a parking lot for the building, or it could be at a location just down the street. Could be at a grocery store. Could be in a library parking lot. Okay. Could be in a public parking garage. I've seen a number of cases where public parking garages will have a certain number of stalls designated for electric vehicles, where parking is actually free if you're there charging.
Right. But that was that property owner deciding to do it, or that city deciding to invest in it. And so in this case, it would be funded through a government program, but could be on private property. Is that kind of...
Well, the way that all of this is built is the state... I shouldn't say all of it. In most cases, the state is providing financial incentives to developers to build the charging. So what the state would need to do to ensure that this speeds up is figure out how much of an incentive needs to be offered to these developers or contractors or property owners to get the construction of these things for the pace to be picked up.
Right. And meanwhile, with the streamlining of the rebates, hopefully the demand matches that.
That's exactly correct.
Right. Okay. Well, let me go ahead and take one more little break right here. Thank you for being on our show. This is Sustainability Now on KSQD Santa Cruz, ksqd.org on the internet, and 90.7 FM. And this is Sustainability Now. We have our guest today, Ben Eichert. Thank you for being here on Sustainability Now. Thank you. And this is Brooke Wright, your host. And also we have Ronnie Lipschitz in the studio as well. Ronnie, did you have anything you wanted to ask?
Well, I wanted to, am I on the air there?
You are on the air.
Okay. Ben, I wanted to just go back and talk a little bit about the cost of electric vehicles. Now, and how big an incentive purchasers of electric vehicles actually get? I mean, is it related to the cost of the car? Is it an absolute sum? And what does it add up to?
Great question. It is, again, at the moment, not quite so straightforward. Yeah. There are a couple of variables. So number one, and I think that this is correct, the way that the state is doing this, there's more money available for low-income consumers than there is for moderate and middle-income consumers. Mm-hmm. And high-income consumers aren't really, you know, I think if you're a single income earner, I think if it's $135,000 or $150,000 or above that you earn each year, you actually don't qualify for any of the state incentives, except for the clean fuel reward.
Yeah.
But those folks are almost certainly going to be able to take advantage of the federal tax incentives.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question is, depends on how much you earn, and it depends on what vehicle you're getting.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example for a lower income individual who wanted to get into an electric vehicle. They could potentially receive somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $14,000 in incentives, potentially even more if they're trading in an older high polluting vehicle. And what's great is that that amount would be sufficient for them to lease a lower cost electrical vehicle for very little money down and very little money a month. In fact, we know of some instances where lower income folks have been able to lease an electric vehicle for, I think, $0 down and about $50 a month.
Wow. Yeah, well, that doesn't seem to me to be very widely known, actually. Now, what are the sources of the funds, the rebate funds? I'm pursuing this because I'm just thinking about issues. I mean, this has come up before on the program, right? The social cost of various kinds of policies, and one of the problems that arises is that these social costs are distributed over the future, and they're very difficult to monetize. And yet, there could be a way of trying to monetize that through bonds or, you know, some sort of mechanism that could actually do more in terms of covering the upfront cost, because, again, the state will benefit, right, from electric vehicles as a whole. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at right now are the benefits to the individuals. So anyway, I mean, my question is, so what are the sources of the funds right now? You mentioned the federal funds, but where else do they come from?
Yeah, in California, for the state incentives for electric vehicles and zero emission vehicles, the funding is coming mostly from two places, either from the Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reduction Fund, otherwise known as cap and trade dollars, or it's coming from the state's general fund. I will let you know a couple of things that I think are important to mention. Number one, the governor's budget proposal earlier this year did increase funding for those programs, and we think that's a great thing. Nevertheless, we think the increase in funding for these programs should be even larger. Mm-hmm. And we have joined together with a coalition called the Charge Ahead Coalition that's requesting basically a doubling of the amount of money put into these programs. The last thing I'll note is that there's a ballot initiative that I believe will be on the ballot in November, and it's being supported by a coalition of folks, but among that coalition are the firefighters, the electrical workers, and California Environmental Voters, one of the largest environmental organizations in the state. That ballot initiative would create a multimillionaire's tax and that would sunset after some period of time, and money from that tax would go into wildfire prevention and zero emission vehicle incentive funds.
I see. Okay.
Interesting.
Brooke, take it over.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so we do want to move on to some other topics, but one last thing on SB 1230, this Electrify California legislation, is you've mentioned, and I've seen it in your literature, that there's a workforce development component to it. And I was just curious if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. We believe, as I've talked about, that California needs to be electrifying at a really rapid pace. But there's a challenge that we're going to confront, which is the fact that if we start electrifying at the pace that we really need to, it's not going to be long before we encounter a shortage of skilled labor, right? Workers that are trained in doing that electrification work. And so one of the ways to address that is through what we're doing, which is to really increase today the amount that we're investing in building the electrification infrastructure, in this case specifically for electric vehicle charging. Already the state law says that when electric vehicle chargers are being built, the contractors need to be making use of certified electricians, and they need to be making use of apprentices and journeymen. That means people who are in training programs to become certified electricians. So by really increasing our investment in charging infrastructure now, we can be supporting the training of skilled workers who will go through those training programs and come out of those programs in a few years, so that as we keep picking up the pace of electrification, that workforce keeps growing and growing, and then we're going to have enough people to do the work.
Got it. Okay. Great. Okay, well, let's move on. And we talked in the beginning that this is part of a larger Green New Deal framework, this particular legislation. So let's talk a little bit more about that bigger Green New Deal. What other legislation might we start seeing as part of the California Green New Deal?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, this goes back just a bit to what, you know, Ronnie was asking about. Funding's got to be a piece of this as well. So this bill, SB 1230, is focusing on program design, but we're also focused this year on pushing for big increases in state spending on these initiatives. And I mentioned this Charge Ahead coalition that we're part of. So that effort to increase the amount of money that the state is dedicating to these programs is part of the overall picture as well. In subsequent years, what I would expect we would want to start focusing on is heavy-duty transportation, so big long-haul trucks, diesel trucks. They're really big contributors not only to the emissions but to toxic air pollutants that create a lot of public health problems. Mm-hmm. So we want to be looking at ways to address heavy-duty transportation. We want to look at ways to address the use of fossil fuels in the home. You know, there's a number of studies that have been coming out in recent years that show children who grow up in homes that have natural gas cooktops are at higher risk for asthma. The pollutants that they're emitting that we don't see inside the home just by having them in the home can actually cause health problems, especially for expectant mothers. We call them natural gas cooktops, but we really should probably call them methane gas cooktops because that's what natural gas is. It's methane, mm-hmm. which is a very dangerous combustible fuel.
Right? Natural.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it seems like, oh, it's natural. It should be safe. But actually, that pilot light that's going on your cooktop or in your hot water heater and your other appliances in the home, it's burning. It's releasing pollutants into the air. And for certain vulnerable populations, it can be particularly dangerous. Right. So that's what I guess, you know, if I were to say, what are we going to work on in the next couple of years? Number one, I hope we're going to get this bill passed this year and we're going to see some good increases in spending in the state. Then I think we want to focus on long-haul transportation, heavy-duty trucks, and on the built environment, the home.
So the California Green New Deal, it is very, it's electrification. Like it's pretty laser-focused on that, or do you see it as a broader kind of framework?
I would say electrification is at the core, but it's definitely not all of it. You know, and you bring up a really good point. Efficiency is a big part of it, right? So efficiency and electrification should go hand in hand. Just because we switch from fossil fuel powered tech to electric tech doesn't mean we're completely eliminating our emissions, right? We still create emissions when we generate electricity. So we want to also support an increase in solar energy, especially distributed solar energy. For those that don't know, distributed solar energy is this idea where you have solar in a lot of places throughout a community. That actually helps harden the grid, makes the grid more resilient to outages and other things. And of course, if we can be capturing energy from the sun and storing it, that's one of the best things we can do. So that's part of what we're focused on as well.
Okay. I didn't hear you mention public transportation. Do you see that as part of it as well, or is that in?
Absolutely. Yeah. There actually is a small part of SB 1230 that would do some things to improve public transportation. But what I'll say generally is that public transportation is almost a world unto itself. And it's just as a smaller organization, it's just an area where we haven't had an opportunity to develop lots of expertise. But you're right, it can't be ignored. It's such a challenging problem in California, right? So many people spend so much time in their cars. It would be really amazing if we could significantly improve public transportation. I'll tell you the one thing that SB 1230 does around that. One of the incentives that low-income folks in California can take advantage of, it's very similar to the Clean Cars for All program. It's called the Clean Vehicle Assistance Program. Our bill says that folks who qualify for that incentive could use the money for non-vehicle transportation. So they could use it on an e-bike. They could use it on a public transit pass.
Ah.
And so, you know, we think it's very important not only to make the transition to electric vehicles, but also when people have an opportunity to get to and from work without a car, you know, by using a bike or public transport, we should be supporting that as well.
Right. Well, and that segues too. You mentioned how, you know, Californians spend so much time in their cars. And the first place that my mind went was, yeah, because the affordable housing is so far from their jobs, right?
Yeah.
So it really does surprise me how often we'll talk about climate issues and not talk about affordable housing. So I just wanted to sort of, put that out there and ask, is that part of the thinking also when you talked about bringing together a lot of stakeholders? Are those stakeholders in the room too to talk about how that would fit in with a Green New Deal?
There are a lot of people that make the connection that you're bringing up, thankfully. I think maybe it's not as widely understood among the public, but among policymakers, it certainly is well understood. Mm-hmm. Because homes are so expensive, especially in certain areas of the state where a lot of the jobs are, people live far away from their jobs, and so they spend all this time commuting. That's contributing to the greenhouse gas emissions problem. And so, right, the idea is, hey, if we could make housing near jobs more affordable, people wouldn't have to commute as much. It's absolutely a valid approach. There's no one approach to all of this. It all really has to be happening.
Right.
Cracking the affordable housing nut in California is a really difficult task. I certainly don't have any answers. I know that there are a lot of efforts being made at the state level, but I don't think, a silver bullet has been found yet. Mm-hmm. But we would certainly support good policy around affordable housing when it's introduced.
Right. Well, and I'll say one reason it comes to my mind too is we had a guest on a few weeks back, maybe a month ago now, that talked about seabed mining for the kinds of minerals that are used in batteries and cars. And it gave me that sense of like, are we just kind of kicking the can down the road when we say, oh, let's, you know, there's an app for that now, or there's a new technology, it's electric cars. But is there a bigger problem that we're not addressing? Now we're going to solve the climate crisis, but are we going to create a new one by needing the resources to build the electric cars? So that's where I was coming from. And I was just curious if you had any thoughts or comments on that. I know it's a hard question, but I think it's an important one too.
It's a hard question. And the climate crisis is a hard challenge, right? It's one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest challenge, I think, that we've faced as a human society. And your question is great, and it's the kind of question I think we need to be asking. Technology has a lot to do with us solving the climate crisis, but it's not only technology, right? There's the climate crisis is a moral and an ethical challenge, and many would say it's also a spiritual challenge in the sense of how are we living in harmony with our Earth, right? Mm-hmm. If we continue to treat the Earth simply as something to be used up for profit, we're always going to be in trouble when it comes to climate. We really do have to change our mentality. I think that's why one of the reasons why the Romero Institute's work with Native American communities is really important as well. There's a different worldview that comes along with that work that's really valuable. Mm. I will say that there are a couple of promising things that I've read very recently. Number one, on the electric vehicle issue, electric vehicles have the potential to last a lot longer than internal combustion engine vehicles, fewer moving parts, right? So if the average life of a gasoline-powered car was 12 years, and the average life of an electric vehicle is going to be, I would say, somewhere between 15 to 20 years, that means we're just going to be using fewer cars. So that's really good, right? We're not going to have to be manufacturing as many. The other thing that's really good is that there's a recent paper that was released that said that a recycled lithium-ion battery is just as good as a brand new lithium-ion battery. So that's really important because it means that once that battery has lived its life for, say, 15 years in an electric vehicle, mm-hmm. we can take it, we can give it a second life and a third life and a fourth life, and we don't have to constantly be finding new minerals to create those batteries. We can be reusing. So, that's actually really Electrify California. Is it about more than electrification? Yes, it is. At the root, it's about reducing, reusing, and recycling. Mm-hmm. Right, but reducing the amount of energy we use through efficiency, reducing the amount of fossil fuels we use by using renewable energy. But those principles that are age-old principles really apply, and we should always be looking at how we can implement them. Reduce, reuse, and recycle.
Right,
and
right.
Thankfully, there's a lot of promise in the recycling of batteries front.
That's really interesting. Let me take us to another break really quick here. You are listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz, KSQD 90.7 FM. KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. This is Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Brooke Wright, with Ronnie Lipschitz in the studio, and our guest is Ben Eichert, from Let's Green California, an initiative of the Romero Institute that is leading on some legislation on California Green New Deal legislation, I'll say. So thanks again, Ben, for being here.
My pleasure.
I was hoping, we just have a few minutes left now, I was hoping that we could talk a little bit more about the Romero Institute in general. Who founded it, and what is its mission?
Sure, yeah. So, well, the Romero Institute, to tell you the truth, I'm not exactly sure who founded it. Oh. But in the late 90s or early 2000s, a new leadership team came into the organization. And two of those folks are a couple who continues to lead the organization to this day. And that's Daniel Sheehan, who's a noted constitutional attorney, and Sarah Nelson, who is the executive director of the organization. Danny Sheehan has worked on a number of really high-profile public interest law cases over the years, including the Pentagon Papers case, Karen Silkwood, the Greensboro Civil Rights Massacre, Iran-Contra. Sarah Nelson used to be the national labor organizer for the National Organization for Women. She also was the executive director at the Christic Institute, which was a nonprofit in D.C. that Danny and Sarah helped run before they assumed leadership of the Romero Institute. And I would say that, you know, overall, you know, what is our mission? Well, we view ourselves as an interfaith nonprofit law and policy center. Interfaith, we're not connected to a religion, but many of us at the organization are motivated by our faith or our spiritual values. Hmm. And we believe in combining public education, grassroots organizing, in-depth investigation, and progressive public policy to rectify structural injustice by building community-driven solutions.
You know, that actually is one thing I was going to ask about, and I wonder if you can answer it. But on the Romero Institute's website, I think I saw that the work on climate change was inspired by Pope Francis's 2015 Laudato Si encyclical. Can you tell us about what the Pope said and how it led to the work happening at the Romero Institute?
Sure.
On climate.
This is when the new Pope came in. It was very soon after Pope Francis assumed his role. I think it was the first encyclical that he released. And I can't even say that I fully understand what an encyclical is, but I think it's an annual or somewhat regular pronouncement or set of policies or guiding principles that the Pope will release.
Okay.
Well, Laudato Si was, I think, the first one that he released, and it was called Caring for Our Common Home. And I think really at the core of it, it said, planet Earth is the common home for all of the human family. And if we believe as people of faith, as Catholics, that we have a moral obligation to help our fellow humans, then we have a moral obligation to care for the earth. The two go hand in hand. They can't be separated. And really tried to take climate change away from being a scientific issue to being a moral and an ethical issue. And our organization's leaders were inspired by that document. And that's when they decided to launch this California-focused climate project. I had worked for the organization for a number of years before that, 2009 to 2012 or so. After they decided to launch this climate program, they invited me to return to the organization, and I did that at the end of 2016 and have been helping to lead this climate initiative since then.
Okay. That's really interesting that was the inspiration at a time that there's so much emphasis on the science side of climate, and then to hear that moral and ethical side, it's fascinating. One other thing, and we've talked about this, is the relationship between the Institute and what is now Central Coast Community Energy. I was wondering if you could share that story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, after the Romero Institute launched its climate initiative, one of the very first things that we did was to support the formation of a community choice energy program for the Monterey Bay area. At the time, it was called Monterey Bay Community Power. Today, it has expanded to serve communities as far south as Carpinteria in the southern parts of Santa Barbara County, all the way up to Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley. What community choice energy is it's a way for communities, either a city or a county or a group of cities and counties, to get together and to take over the process of procuring energy for electrical energy customers. So it doesn't completely displace PG&E or Southern California Edison or whoever the big utility company is, but it takes over a part of their role, the part of securing, procuring energy for customers. And so it's a publicly run utility of sorts. PG&E still handles the wires and the lines and the poles and the billing, but this entity, which is publicly owned and run, purchases and procures energy for customers. We were ambassadors for that program, and we focused on outreach and education in Spanish-speaking communities, low-income communities, primarily in the Salinas Valley and in San Benito County. And I'm really proud to say that when the program launched in 2017, I think it was 19 of the 21 eligible jurisdictions joined the program. It was the most diverse program geographically, and it was the first community choice energy program in the state to launch with such a significant number of low-income and disadvantaged communities and primarily minority communities at launch. Usually what the pattern had been is these programs would launch in more affluent coastal communities and then several years later spread out to other communities. We launched as an inclusive program, and we were really proud to be part of that work.
And what does that mean for the community? Like, in what way is that a service?
Is that in what way is the community choice energy a service?
Yeah. And the fact that it was, you know, you're talking about it came directly to underserved communities. Why was that an important thing to you?
Well, it's an important thing to us because we believe firmly that low-income communities, frontline communities, what we mean by frontline are these are the communities that have borne the brunt of the negative impacts of our treatment of the planet, and they bear the brunt of the impacts of climate change. These are the communities that need to lead our transition to a sustainable future. It's the right thing to do. It's the just thing to do. And if we don't do it that way, we're frankly not going to succeed. So it's important to us because it's the right thing to do. It's also important to us because community choice energy can provide energy at a lower cost. But more importantly than that, it's actually what these communities wanted to do. When we were organizing in these communities, a lot of people suspected that the people in these communities weren't going to even know or care about climate change. But we found exactly the opposite. What we found is that people understood what's happening to the planet. They understood that something needed to be done about it, but they just didn't know what tools were available for them as a community to do. And so once they learned that joining community choice energy was something that their community could do and it would have a significant impact, they were totally supportive, and they organized, they educated their neighbors, they mobilized, they turned up at their city council meeting, and they really demanded that their community join the program.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Ben Eichert, for being our guest on Sustainability Now. Listeners, you can find out more about the Romero Institute, Let's Green California, and Electrify California by looking online for their websites. And you are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, ksqd.org, streaming on the internet.
And as a reminder, shows from this particular Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. if you're an early bird. And if you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. So thanks for listening, and thanks to Annamalee Dunham for helping today with engineering the show. And thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now. Avenue.
Electric Avenue.
Rock it in the night.
Take it higher.
Electric Avenue.